Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Why are some affluent young city women dressing like members of religious cults or their mothers?
Downplaying the assets, wearing clothing that is, you know, would be in a different context considered dowdy, considered unflattering, sack-like, maybe even cultish. So this is something that has been going on among design houses like Celine, for instance, you know, kind of extremely expensive, extremely chic fashions.
We'll talk about the new modesty in fashion and whether it has anything to do with averting the male gaze. First up, KCRW comes up for air. In the event you ever wondered, the CRW in our station's name stands for College Radio Workshop. And for the last 33 years, we've been broadcasting out of a basement of the Santa Monica College cafeteria. Now, this space is famously unpleasant, airless and fluorescent lit, but we are soon to move into a bright new above-ground building by architect Clive Wilkinson. He once described our current basement to an LA Weekly reporter as subhuman.
Well, it was subhuman, but it was also a very charming, closely lived environment. It's hard to sort of really communicate smells and things like that over the air, but it was a hard-working basement.
Clive Wilkinson and his team began work on KCRW's new building around a decade ago. A Santa Monica bond measure paid for the construction and KCRW capital campaign donors, now that's over 5,800 families who gave a dollar or more, well, they paid for the broadcast equipment and technology. The building joins two classroom buildings at the college's satellite campus at Olympic and Stewart, walking distance from the expo line. These three surround a plaza, and together they make up the Center for Media and Design. After some construction delays, the building's now nearing completion, and this Saturday, supporters will get a sneak peek. DNA went to the site for its own sneak peek and found a beige brick and yellow panel building. It feels somewhat industrial, somewhat pop. The yellow signals public areas like the large staircase that projects from the building and a shared outdoor terrace. And the plaza has a stage that slopes down to the ground, and on that slope is a trickling water fountain.
We saw the configuration really of the three buildings going from conventional older school instruction in the old building in a full circle to KCRW itself being the kind of totally grown-up version of broadcasting to the world.
But they're united aesthetically or visually by the brick and then a lot of splashy yellow. Is that a favourite colour of yours, Clive?
Yellow is a favourite colour of mine. It is a happy colour. It's sunshine and optimism. And it happens to go quite well with the brick and really was seen as a counterpoint to the brick to thread the buildings together.
One thing that interests me about the look is you started designing this, what, about a decade ago, is that correct?
2008 we began.
And at that point, I think it's fair to say that it was very fashionable in architecture at that point to play with digital effects, laser-cut metals, lots of complex curves,
yes.
Lacy designs, utilising the latest in digital technologies. You have not done any of that.
No, we didn't. We actually avoided it because we didn't really know much about how to do that sort of thing.
Is that really the reason why?
Possibly not. I'm very, very influenced by context. I really believe in growing a project out of its existing context. We're really not that interested in frivolous technological developments. So I think that this will stand the test of time. It's a building that's of its place and I think has a sort of classic simplicity about it as well.
Let's talk about how this is not just a building. It is a building within an environment that is meant to engender a sense of community.
Absolutely.
Will bands play on the stage? In fact, bands that are playing at KCRW?
Bands are absolutely expected to play at that stage, and I'm sure that'll be a large part of its programming.
And if the water was to get in the way of the music, if it was to be too loud for the music, could you turn off the water?
You can tune the water.
You can?
Yes. You just slow down its pace and it'd be very quiet.
Nice.
You know, it's like dimming a light bulb. I think it's that simple, quite honestly.
Now, this stage represents one of the biggest changes that this new building spells for KCRW. Inside and out, there will be spaces for you, our listeners, to attend music performances and news and talk events. And that includes the main performance studio space inside the building, where MBE concerts will be recorded.
It is actually, almost the keystone of the entire building. The performance space was the first space that was planned on the ground with a floating slab, with close study of the acoustics within the space, how to actually get the ability for an audience at mezzanine level to be able to connect without distracting the performers on the space. It's almost like a musical instrument in itself, I think. And that has taken a lot of time fine-tuning. And then, of course, the upstairs area is as an open dynamic office space.
Open dynamic office space. That's been one of your, I guess, signature contributions. You've created a lot of quite noted office spaces, including Googleplex, Chai at Day. In the intervening years, the very open space has become a little bit less desired by a lot of people. They've wanted quieter space, but we're going into a space that's very, very open.
Well, you are and you aren't. The formula keeps changing for designing office space in a good way. And increasingly, although the primary message with office space today is open, there's usually a large variety of enclosed quiet spaces that encircle open office conditions where people can break away, make phone calls. Phone booths is a kind of a new term in office design. And having a range of different possible elective spaces to use really changes the dynamic between a concern about focused work versus collaborative work.
Now, we've already talked a little bit about the exterior and how it has a somewhat pop quality and it has your favourite colour, yellow. And then you go inside and there's white walls and there's a sort of muted kind of beigey grey wall area. And then there's a bright orange, vivid conference room. In fact, there's two of them. And then there's another conference room which has a wall that is fluorescent yellow and a carpet to match. Lovers of pop will love it. But already I've been around with some of my colleagues and they've gone in and said, oh my God, being in this orange room is so strange. Are they really workable spaces with those colours?
We've actually done coloured glass meeting rooms a lot in the last 10 years for numerous clients. And they're actually very popular. You have to go through a small perceptual change about how you look at your environment. But believe me, a coloured glass meeting room is nicer to be in than a plain glass meeting room because you're not on display in the same way. People are a little more screened by coloured glass rooms.
So there's the perceptions for the people working in the space, and then there's our listeners, many of whom were us before we got involved with the station, have absolutely associated KCW with being this scrappy little organisation, you know, operating on a shoestring, not wasting any of the money that we raise from our generous listeners. And here we are going into a building designed by you that has designed other spaces for advertising agencies, banks, tech companies. The building's really going to be nice. And yet, we don't want to come across as kind of having gotten above ourselves, you know? How do you resolve that?
I actually, in spite of whatever you might think in looking at the outside of the building, it's a shed as a building. It's very simple. It's very industrial internally. Money that was spent on the building almost exclusively has gone to the production values of KCRW. It's gone into the technology, which is often very sophisticated. So I don't personally think that anyone's getting above themselves because I think a lot of restraint was exercised, you know, in choosing the furniture for the KCRW people. It really was, you know, practically IKEA. I mean, there was no extra money spent on any kind of luxuries for the people.
That's Clive Wilkinson. So the new building may not be luxurious, but it's a far cry from the cramped confines of the basement. So how do some of our colleagues feel about this upcoming move? We asked them.
My name is Bob Carlson. I'm the host of Unfictional. I always felt when down here in the basement, we were apart from the world and we were commenting on the world, but we were down in our own bunker. And you would come up and you would literally feel like you were emerging from a hole and the world looked different and you didn't even realize. It was like Vegas where you didn't know what time it was. I think in the new place, we're going to now feel a part of the world as opposed to a hole down in the ground separate from the world.
My name is Stephen Herbert, and I'm the chief engineer here. It's going to be a big cultural shift. In the new facility, quite frankly, it's big enough that we could lose a few people in there. The best thing is the fact that our kitchen will have a sink and that our restrooms will be more than just two stalls.
Hi, my name's Ariana Morgenstern. I am currently in the music department as executive producer of the department. Most of the people here have studio tans, meaning that they are the palest people on the planet. They're going to get some vitamin D. Is there anything to miss in the basement? Yeah, I'm going to miss the stink sometimes. I will miss the not having a sink in the kitchen. I will miss those days when the air conditioner goes out and everybody's in a sauna. Yeah, there's plenty to miss that way.
My name is Matt Holzman, and I'm the producer and host of The Document. It's interesting. My opinion about the move has changed a lot since we've started to visit the new building. I mean, I'm starting to really understand the circumstances that we work in. Like, I know we talk about it during the drive, but I'm really now starting to see just how untenable this situation is. You can change or you can pay more for staying the same. And I think this is a perfect example of that.
That was Matt Holzman. You also heard from Ariana Morgenstern, Steve Herbert, and Bob Carlson. And we've been talking about KCRW's new and first building of its own. It opens for a sneak peek for donors this Saturday, and staff will move in beginning in January 2018. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. After this break, why are beautiful young women dressing to conceal?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Should women consider their clothing choices when partaking in the world of men? That's been one of the many heated topics raised by the current debate surrounding sexual harassment. Gymnast Gabby Douglas, fashion designer Donna Karan, and Big Bang Theory star Mayim Bialik all managed to enrage many women recently when they suggested they might consider the wisdom of wearing highly provocative clothing. Each was accused of victim blaming and had to walk back their comments. But clothing does project a message, and we'll hear how this is being explored in the worlds of design and fashion. First, let's hear from a recent guest on DNA, building contractor Joan Barton. As part of her narrative about making it in the predominantly male world of construction, she spoke to us about dress.
People ask me all the time, why do you dress the way that you dress in jeans and these big boots and, you know, you should show off your body? I've heard that so many times. Why would I want to show off my body in a work situation where it's going to attract attention that is not only detrimental to the project I'm trying to finish, but detrimental to my position as the head of this project? Because I'm very aware of what I look like. I'm very aware of how I can use that to get what I want. If I do dress it up and put on the heels and the makeup and the hair and do the whole thing to go to a job site, then what I'm asking for is for people to pay attention to me in a different way. I'm not asking them to assault me, and I want to make that very clear. But I am changing the tone of my goal.
That was Dirty Girl Construction's Joan Barton. The tone of their goal is something that women and men project consciously and unconsciously every time they put on an item of clothing. Nomi Fry recently wrote in the New York Times Tea magazine about a fascinating trend for willowy young women to dress modestly in styles that bring to mind Amish women or characters out of The Handmaid's Tale. We reached her by phone at her office in New York.
Obviously, religious women of different stripes have dressed modestly over centuries, but this is a more specifically a kind of style that has been adopted by, you know, metropolitan, sophisticated, upper middle class, professional women, and also women who are young in their 20s and 30s. At the height of what's usually considered a time to kind of
flaunt your figure,
flaunt your assets, so to speak.
And this is downplaying the assets.
Yeah, so downplaying the assets, wearing clothing that is, you know, would be in a different context considered dowdy, considered maybe unflattering, sack-like, maybe even cultish. So this is something that has been going on among design houses like Celine, for instance, you know, kind of extremely expensive, extremely chic fashions, as well as New York designers like Rachel Comey or Number Six or Maria Cornejo. It's really seeming to be something that younger women are gravitating towards nowadays.
Well, and you explore this trend at a very timely moment, as in a moment where sexual harassment is being discussed by so many people. And one of the kind of sidebar conversations is women's self-presentation.
Yes, it's interesting because, you know, I've been working on this article before the Harvey Weinstein news made it out. But I think it is true that it is coinciding with it, and I have been following with interest some of these women's claims that, you know, that if women were to dress more modestly, then sexual harassment wouldn't be a problem. So I'd like to state, first of all, that I don't think that's the case. I think sexual harassment is, you know, something that can't be blamed on the way a woman dresses. And that said, I do think that women are always somehow the ones who have to manage this, right? So whether they dress more provocatively or more modestly, the onus is somehow always on the woman to handle the problem of the woman's body in the public sphere. Now, this isn't to say that women aren't responsible for their own choices and so on, but somehow in these conversations, what always gets left out is the man's agency, right? And his ability to manage his expectations or his
or his instinct,
so,
or his urges. Because
yes.
I do think that also what's been left out of this conversation is the fact that we humans aren't entirely cerebral or intellectual. We do have kind of animal instincts. And what we're talking about here is the degree to which men should be better able to contain their animal instincts and the degree to which women might consider ways to armor themselves against those instincts or not.
Yes. And I get that. You know, as one of the women I interviewed in my piece, Hannah Hoffman, who has a gallery actually in Los Angeles, a contemporary art gallery, and is, you know, a very successful, accomplished young woman, and she prefers to dress more modestly. And she said, I prefer, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but she said something like, I prefer to have collectors, male collectors or curators and so on, all the people she comes in contact with on a daily basis, keep their minds on the art, you know, not get confused about what is being transacted here, right? Especially because she's a young, attractive woman. But at the same time, I think she was also questioning why it was her who had to manage these expectations.
If they had a choice, do you think they'd like to redesign the men themselves, reprogram them so they don't have those instincts?
I do think that in so many ways, our society has made progress since we were in the jungles, but apparently, you know, as we're seeing, it's a major issue.
But let's go back to sack-like clothing. In fact, there was a tweet about one of the dresses made by Creatures of Comfort, dun-coloured, ankle-length, high-necked, voluminous-sleeved. You quote a tweet that describes a dress as, it's a party dress, a Donna party dress.
Right, yeah.
And then you have a tweet from a writer, Dori Shafria, who writes, bless everyone who is pretty enough, skinny enough, and rich enough to wear this dress. There's a somewhat related trend right now called menocore, where, again, young, attractive, somewhat affluent women are dressing in kind of loose-fitting Eileen Fisher-style clothing that one associates more with women after menopause. But emphasis being on the attractive piece, there are many women who are not the recipients of the male gaze because they're not pretty and actually would love to be the recipient of the male gaze. So to what extent is this choice the choice of women who actually are privileged enough to be beautiful?
Yes, I think that's a piece of the puzzle for sure. And I think that these tweets that you quoted definitely spoke to that, because there is a sense, and I think I say this in my story, that this trend can be taken as something of a humble brag, right? So it's like, I am a youngish, usually white, affluent or affluentish woman whose body fits a certain conventional stereotype of what is considered attractive. And so I'm so attractive and all of these other things that I just noted that I can even wear a sack and look great, you know, like to borrow that, like she'd look great with a sack over her head, you know, and so on. I think that's definitely part of that. And I think there is a sense in which, you know, fashion often turns things around, right? It's like, it's the same thing, you know, where when we had the normcore trend a couple of years ago and women, like 23-year-old women, were dressing like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, and still looking great. And it was kind of the same thing, you know. It's like, I am not going to dress in a way that's conventionally attractive to the male gaze. And it's almost like a flex, you know, I'm going to get that gaze anyway. So, yeah, I think as in all things fashion, fashion is often for the young, rich, and attractive. You know?
You're listening to Nomi Fry. She wrote about modest dressing for the New York Times Tea magazine. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Now, you heard Nomi talk about the young gallerist Hannah Hoffman, who wears curated outfits chosen to reinforce her purpose. You can find a similar attitude among many in the design community in LA. Inga-Lil Walrus-Ritter is Dean of Woodbury University School of Architecture, and she's given a lot of thought to the semiotics of clothing.
25 years ago, when I first started working as an architect, women started wearing suits. And so it was the power suit moment, I would say, in architecture, where women were then presenting themselves as equal, as, you know, I'm exactly like you. There's no difference between, you know, a male architect or a female architect. We're all architects. I'm become far more interested now in presenting myself and celebrating my womanhood and finding ways of wearing clothes that can express, you know, through color and texture and fashion and, you know, a way of presenting and a way of designing. You know, the clothing is a calling card saying that, you know, design doesn't end at a building, that design is complete and total, that everything in the world at every scale is an opportunity for a design problem. And I think that in architecture, that's very ingrained, this idea of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the Bauhaus, that
the total artwork.
Exactly, the total work of art, that everything down to the smallest scale, the jewelry, the detail, the glasses, the shoes, and then on up to the city and the design of people and how they operate in a city, those are all design opportunities. And I think that clothing for me is exactly that. It's one other layer of design opportunity.
So let's take a break and have you describe what you're wearing.
I am wearing a fake fur blue sweater that was designed by Carol Young, who's an architect and now has a store on Hillhurst called Undesigned, and is really fascinated with, you know, really simple cuts. You know, it's I would say, growing out of the Yamamoto, you know, looking at tailoring and beautiful fabrics, really simple designs that recognize the woman's body without being explicit about it. I'm also wearing a ring designed by a colleague of mine, Yisho Ye. The necklace is Oropopo. It's a laser-cut leather. And Oropopo is their young couple designers in New Mexico, and they're also architect-trained. And then the trousers are comfortable, bell-bottomed, I would say. You're flared, colorful, and they're designed by a local Los Angeles designer. And then finally, my glasses are LA Eyeworks. Your colleague Avishai recognized me from as an architect from my glasses. And then on my feet, I'm wearing Trippin shoes, which is a handmade leather shoe from Germany. They're very fashionable, but they're incredibly comfortable.
There's a lot of architects that are very careful about what they wear because, as you say, it's an extension of their kind of total design philosophy. I think it's also fair to say that oftentimes that means they wind up wearing only black. You don't fall into that camp.
That's true. And I would say, you know, and this is a broad generalization, but, you know, architects, we're a tribe, and our uniform tends to be, and I sit on reviews constantly, I'm sitting in meetings, where everybody is wearing black. And it's easy to differentiate yourself from that tribe by wearing a lot of color.
But to the extent one can generalize at all about the tribe, and let's say the subgroup within the tribe, which is the women of the tribe, is it fair to say that there is a tendency to wear clothing that... it's certainly about making a visual statement, but it often is not about hugging the female form.
So in architecture parlance, the word detail refers to the drawing an architect makes. That is an instruction to the builder, to the contractor, to put materials together. So you have a detail of a glass, a window meeting the wall, or you have the detail of a door pull. The word detail, the etymology of it is détaille, which is to tailor, which is the French word of tailoring. And so I think this fascination with craft and tailoring is something that's absolutely appreciated by architects. And so they are choosing clothing that are tailored and crafted in unique ways. And those tend to be idiosyncratic ways that are, you know, if you think about the Japanese designers, for example, or Comme des Garçons, Yoshi Yamamoto, these are designers who are more fascinated with unusual profiles. And it's not really about, you know, form-hugging, for example, clothing, but it's really about showcasing an artistry and craft.
That was Ingalill Valrhus-Ritter. She's Dean of the Architecture School at Woodbury University. Now let's go back to Nomi Fry with the New York Times Tea Magazine and the young women who are wearing sackcloth dresses. Like these detail-conscious architects, they're invariably choosing dresses that are actually beautifully constructed and in themselves do make a visual statement.
Yeah, for sure. It's almost like a conceptual statement of like, okay, here I am presenting myself in a certain way, and I'm saying this thing with what I'm choosing to wear, as one would were one to wear something, you know, more revealing. It's a different kind of vocabulary, basically. And I think, you know, with fashion in the sense of like, is this regressive? Is this progressive? I usually tend to write with an argument in mind. And one of the things that I found myself doing when I was writing it is realizing that I didn't have any simple answers about what this means.
That was Nomi Fry, writer and author of an article published earlier this month in the New York Times Tea Magazine called Modest Dressing as a Virtue. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. And thank you very much for listening.